Shrink Wrap Radio number 666, Thoughts on the Evolution of Psychoanalysis, with psychoanalyst Amanda Lennox.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is psychoanalyst Amanda Lennox. She works in New York City as a psychotherapist and supervisor at Blanton Peale Psychoanalytic Counseling Center, and is also in private practice in Herald Square, where she works as a psychotherapist and supervisor at Blanton Peale Psychoanalytic Counseling Center, and also has a private practice in Herald Square, where she works with adults, adolescents, and children. For more information about Amanda Lennox, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Amanda Lennox, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I've been listening to this show for a really long time. It got me through my master's program with a little more help. So I really appreciate being here, and I'm super excited.
Well, that's great. I'm so pleased to hear that this show has played a role in your academic life and your professional life. And how was it helpful to you?
Well, you know, when you're in your master's programs, you're reading textbooks, and that's great. But it's also nice to hear in real time what people are doing and how they've used their knowledge and what they've come to learn themselves along the way. So I just felt like it was a little more organically relatable to me. Just hearing what everyone has to say from such a wide range. I mean, you have so many guests on that really cover a lot of topics. So it filled in a lot of the gaps that my master's program didn't really offer.
I think your guest number 668, if I'm right. Maybe it's 667.
It's incredible.
It's right in there somewhere. And I always love it when somebody who's been a listener moves up in their career and kind of graduates to the place where they say, hey, you know, I think I'm
a
guest.
Congratulations. Thank you.
When
I started out, I really felt like I didn't know very much. I came from another career prior to. And so, it's a thrill to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm interested in finding out more about you. What was your undergraduate major?
My undergrad was in dance education, primarily modern, but it covered also ballet and jazz. And I danced professionally for some time. I taught at some schools, and eventually I came to a point where I was not as, like, I felt like I hit a ceiling with it, and I was not as interested in the ethics of the profession. I felt like the moral compass is very skewed in the dance world. And so I decided to go back to school for therapy. And now that's my specialty. I work with people in the entertainment industry so that they can try to stay as organized as possible and within the range, within the scope of what is offered to them.
You know, I have to ask you about the skewed ethics in the dance industry. Tell us about those.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Sounds like it might be fodder for a TV show or something.
Yeah. Well, luckily, growing up, I danced at a school that didn't have so much of that problem. So when I went to college, it started to creep in, just depending on the teachers who were training us at the time and what their experiences were. But dance ballet was created by Catherine de' Medici and King Louis XIV. So it has in the root of it totalitarianism at its core. So you still see that today. It's the king. The king tells the peasants what to do, so to speak, the choreographer to the dancers. And it's very much like you do what I say or get out. And the body stuff, you know, being, I was told I was fat. I'm not fat at all.
No, I would say not.
I was, you know, you're shamed constantly. They think shame is what gets you to perform. They don't pay you. They expect you to do things for free and then they'll berate you if you don't. It's just, even, I remember sitting once with a choreographer and we were just having lunch and they said to me, "Oh, you have carbs on your plate." And I was like, "Yeah, I do. I like to eat. I'm an eater. I don't starve myself. And what is that? Well, you're not my nutritionist." So it just became where I felt really down. And it was sad because I lost my drive to perform and what I love to do. Like it changed how I process.
Yeah. Yeah. Dance. Wow. What, it's too bad that you kind of lost the joy that you had for that activity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, you know, it's joyful for me to then at least try to work with people who do want to be a part of the industry still. And
yeah. I'm wondering if psychotherapy, did you go to psychotherapy around this issue or other issues in your life?
I didn't start therapy until I quit dancing for the company I was working for. And then I started therapy like a week later, because at that point, a close friend was, you know, talking to me about what I was going to do next. And they had said, "You know, you really don't seem that happy. Like, have you thought about going back to school?" And if, you know, I was like, "Yeah, I would do that maybe." And they were like, "Well, what would you go for?" And it must have already been in my preconscious because I just blurted out therapy. Like I'd never thought about it before. It wasn't like I was like early on, like, "I want to be a therapist. This is what I'm going to do." It just happened that day. And then like a week later, I enrolled in a master's program. And like a month later after that, you know, the dancer in me is like, you know, if you want to be a choreographer, you're a dancer first. Same with therapy. I felt like if I wanted to be a therapist, I needed to be a patient. And I lived right next to the Philadelphia School of Psychoanalysis. So I popped on over there and I was knocking on the door a few times trying to get someone to answer. You know, no one answered. And then I went back like 2 days later and I went back. I kept going because I thought, "Oh, I know what I've heard about psychoanalysis. So I imagine I could find a therapist at this place." And eventually someone answered and I got linked up with the dean of the program there and, you know, as my analyst. And then I found out it was a school. Like, I didn't really understand at first.
It sounds like you didn't know much about psychoanalysis when you began this.
Yeah, no, I didn't know. I knew the ego, id, and the superego, and even that's distorted. But I just knew basic Freud. I had taken like one class in my undergrad about psychology, and we read, you know, Freud for beginners.
Yeah.
So I had no idea what I was walking into.
Fascinating. I had a similar experience when I went to my doctoral program. I decided that I wanted to be a psychotherapist. Little did I know that the program that I was accepted into was very, very psychoanalytic. I had to wrestle with that because I really came into it very naively and I experienced that program, and some of it was where I was, you know, in my life and kind of psychologically unsophisticated person, but interested in having conversations with people about the brass tacks of what it was to, you know, to be conscious and alive and so on. And I had fantasies of becoming a novelist and ended up getting my bachelor degree in creative writing.
Okay.
And so my initial take as a rebellious young man in the 60s was, and it could be unique to this program. And I don't think it was. I experienced it as authoritarian. kind of similar to your story about the world of dance. It seemed authoritarian and kind of very prescriptive and judgmental and things like that. I learned a lot despite myself. And
sure.
Yeah. So what was your master's in?
My master's was in mental health counseling.
Okay.
And I did that at the same time that I, you know, after I got linked with my analyst, and he was like, after a month of working with him, he said, you know, this is an institute, right? Like, I think maybe you might be great in the classes. And so I was like, oh, cool. Okay, great. Like, sign me up. I want to be there. And it just ended up working out so perfectly for my personality type. But it's a modern analytic institute, and there's only a select few of those. They're not. There's one, the Philadelphia School, and then there's the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies in New York. The Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy Study Center in New York also has a track that has they teach multiple aspects of psychoanalysis, but modern is one of them. And then there were some smaller institutes that I really had to search for to find that have some modern analytic premise to them, but there's really not that many. I think Boston, although I'm not too familiar with their school there, it's a lot different than classical, the judgmental, authoritarian experience that a lot of people do have.
I rebelled against, yeah. So yeah. How long was that program?
I was in that program for 10 years.
That sounds like psychoanalysis. Yeah. It's a big thing to take on, you know?
Yeah, I heard I heard somewhere that it's the longest. It's not really considered medical anymore. You don't have to be an MD to become an analyst anymore, but it's one of the longest medical tracks, yeah, depending on which school you go to.
Yeah, definitely sounds like it. It's like I did 2 years for a master's and 6 years for a PhD, so that's 8 years. And I thought somewhere along the line, geez, I could have gone to medical school here in that amount of time.
I didn't
choose to do it, partly because I thought, well, that's going to take way too long.
Yes. And I ended up being, I know some schools in New York, they have a 4-year track, but it's I didn't do that. You know, I took the long route because I just learned more, and I learned it better for me that way. But yeah, some people do it shorter.
Yeah. So if we were to break it down to this simplest bifurcation, there's classical psychoanalysis and there's modern psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
And
there's also more. There's several other identities in the analytic world now. There's ego psychology, there's object relations. So there's, neoclassical. So different institutes pocket different theorists.
Right.
Yeah. So modern. Go ahead.
I don't know if I've ever used the phrase modern psychoanalysis, but certainly I was aware that, it had evolved and been changing, and there were these other schools that specialized in one particular approach or not. But your institute and some related ones evidently are using that term, modern psychoanalysis, in a rather specific way.
Yeah.
So what I'd like to explore with you is to learn more about what that specific way is, calling modern psychoanalysis.
Well, a lot of people, they like to use the phrase, I think that's more widespread, psychodynamic, that sort of encompasses like the wider range beyond classical. But modern psychoanalysis is specifically, creation of a particular theorist. So his name is Hyman Spotnitz.
Okay.
And he
lived when?
I think he died in 2008. Okay. But his primary work was in the 50s. He did a lot of writing around that time.
Okay.
He coined the phrase modern psychoanalysis. So there are other contemporary versions of psychoanalysis, but his was specifically titled modern.
Okay. So tell us more about Spotnitz and what he introduced
How
did he shape it up?
Spotnitz, there's a lot of people that were, this is one of the things that when I got into the Institute in Philadelphia, I didn't know anything about this. I thought there was Freud and that's it.
Right.
And, or Jung, I was familiar with that, like the small circle of people, but there were a lot of theorists that spawned from Freud.
Right.
And Spotnitz was influenced by, a lot of them. And so a select few, in particular, Ferenczi, he pushed from Freud's initial viewpoint that psychoanalysis is not for people who suffer from pre-Oedipal conditions. Freud thought that psychoanalytic candidates were really at an Oedipal level. So he was very vocal that he didn't want to work with people who were on the more regressed or more primitive areas. Mm-hmm. But Ferenczi came along and he was like, actually, I'm working with a lot of people who are at pre-Oedipal levels. And I think we should start talking more about treating the wide range of the population rather than just the select few that are really cooperative and at a higher level to begin with.
Always loved his name, Sándor Ferenczi.
Yeah, it's great. And so from him.
Sounds like a gypsy violinist.
Yeah, I love that. Spotnitz, was influenced by his work. And then he was also influenced by Wilhelm Reich, who talked a lot about character analysis and how, a symptom in a patient could be looked at as an object. Like the patient usually knows this is not syntonic to me. It's like a foreign thing. I notice it. I'm uncomfortable by it and I want to fix it. I want to do something with it. But then there's also parts that are more characterologically driven that the patient is not exactly aware of. And so Reich talked mostly about character armor and defenses that are so ingrained in a person that they don't even know, which Spotnitz was influenced by.
Well, also that the character armor is expressed in the body, right? And as a dancer, that's something I would think you would be.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I love anything psychosomatic. And to continue, Glover was also a theorist that he took to that. Freud's original thoughts were blank screen. You're the surgeon. You come in, you do the job. You don't bring yourself into it. You just do what you need to do for the client. And Glover started the conversation of, well, what about counter resistance? What if the patient needs to say something that's so disturbing that the analyst doesn't want to hear it? How do we handle these things? Another theorist that Spotnitz was influenced by, Fairbairn in the object relations world, Balint, who spoke about the basic fault in that there's a fault line in your maturational development. Usually, nobody usually graduates from childhood like perfectly. So there are places along the way that there might be a basic fault and things tend to bubble up there that is reasons why patients usually come into treatment. Guntrip, he started to discuss what does the patient need? I mean, are we really just giving interpretations or are we going to come in and actually explore the patient and find out where they're at and what's what we can do for them? There's also Winnicott, who spoke about infantile, like things on an infantile level, what's happening at the oral level. Countertransference came into the picture with Searless and Kernberg. He talked about the consistency of the environment in the treatment room, setting boundaries with clients. So what ended up happening is Spotnitz sort of like took all of these concepts and he roped them in and he kind of like braided them all together and created his book, Modern Psychoanalysis of the Schizophrenic Patient. It's a wonderful book for anyone who's looking to know more. And he created techniques. So a lot of the other psychoanalytic tracks, a lot of them focus on interpretation. Like you give it insight to the client and then the client is cured or something like that. But Spotnitz, he took it down to a pre-Oedipal level with his techniques that he created in order to do two things for the client, which is help the client resolve disruptions in maturational development and to start to metabolize aggression turned inward. So he thought the narcissistic defense of I need to preserve the object so I can stay alive at an infantile level early in life. That's what children tend to do. And like our society tends to foster that. His techniques helped to dissolve aggression turned inward.
Okay. You're using some psychoanalytic jargon here. So I need to back you up a little bit. One was you're talking about he's interested in pre-Oedipal. Exactly what do you mean by that? Not everybody is going to have a good sense of what that means.
Pre-Oedipal would mean, people use Oedipal, the Oedipal complex, to talk about your relationship with your parents or how your parents have influenced you. And that's usually later in life, like when you're like 7 years old. But what happened before that? You know, how did they handle feeding you when you were an infant? How did they handle cleaning you? How did they handle touching you? Did they hold you or did they leave you to cry and not interact with you at all?
Yeah. So today we have that whole area is known as attachment, right?
Exactly.
Disorders. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So half of what I learned.
Some of the groundwork for that.
Absolutely. Half of the track at least at the Philadelphia school, I don't know about CMPS, what their curriculum is like exactly, but in Philadelphia, half of our training was attachment theory. I mean, Beatrice Beebe, Bowlby, Ainsworth, like a lot of different theorists who really look at the parent-infant relationship.
Right. And I was also struck because you said I was on the edge of asking you, well, did he write a book? And then you mentioned that I guess a major book of his is about working with schizophrenia. Which was probably pretty radical at the time, right? Because I think the general sense was, no, we work with neurotic people, but not severely.
I think the story goes that Spotnitz was actually a maverick, and his graduation committee was very unhappy with him because he wanted to present his final case at the institute he was with on a schizophrenic person, and they said, no, we don't do that. So he left the school and he started his own track with the modern.
Yeah. So you talked about,
did I take you all over the place?
Oh, interpretations. That's the other thing I wanted to pick up on, is that in the classical form, and we haven't talked about free association yet either.
We will get there.
So that the patient is on a couch and is free associating, and the analyst is presenting, at least the way the story is told, kind of a blank screen that is not revealing much about themselves, not talking about themselves, not talking about their family or their early life or anything like that, but rather listening very deeply, closely, and then coming up with some observation known as an interpretation, which is supposed to sort of almost magically bump the person up.
Insight, right?
Their insight, their self-understanding.
So, yes, modern analysts specifically don't do that. We do use the couch. I have clients who lay down. But we're a lot less interested in insight as the cure, because that is, insight is usually injurious to the patient. Interpretations from the analyst are usually considered threatening, because when a person comes in at a status quo level, like, or, you know, how they come in the way that we spoke about earlier with Reich, suggesting that people have syntonic relationships with their own selves. So for someone like me to come in and say...
That's another fancy psychoanalytic word.
Yeah.
Syntonic and dystonic.
Right, yeah.
And basically what it means, right, is it feels natural and fits with your personality, or it doesn't. Dystonic means this doesn't feel like me. I don't like it. I don't want it.
Right. So it's always better when the client tells you.
Yeah. Go ahead.
That something is syntonic or dystonic, or fits with them or doesn't fit with them, rather than you telling them. Like, you know, I'm not going to tell a client if they come in, I'm not going to interpret. And people get so consumed with this. They're always nervous. Well, not always. I mean, I'm generalizing, but a lot of people will come in and they're very nervous that I'm going to tell them something about themselves.
Right. Something horribly revealing.
Yeah. And to their credit, like, that's what psychoanalysis used to be. And a lot of people do still train that way. I mean, there are classical institutes, but, the modern institute, we tend to shy away from that. We don't like that. It usually makes a person more psychotic than help them get better, especially if they're coming in with the earlier conflicts that we talked about. They're going to be more sensitive to the material that you might suggest. And that could be an assumption anyway. Who knows? I mean, it's better if they really tell you.
Yeah. So you still use the couch, and is the person encouraged to engage in free association?
Okay, sure. So yes, we do use the couch. Not every modern analyst is, I mean, everyone takes a different approach. I use it with patients. They don't have to use it. I'll just introduce it as something that I might ask them about in the first session. Is usually I'll bring it up and I'll get their response to it. And if they're interested in it, great. If they're not interested in it, great. No problem. Like, it's not about the couch. It's about studying transference and resistance. That's psychoanalysis in a nutshell. So as long as that's happening, it really doesn't matter to modern analysts the same way that it matters to a classical analyst. We don't like for the client to feel like they have to conform to the treatment. We want to know where they're at. We encourage them to come in where they are, and then we work with them to give them what we can, with less rigid rules, so to speak.
Yeah. You mentioned that you were in the program for 10 years. You don't look that old.
No.
When did you graduate from the program? How many years have you been after being a psychoanalyst?
Yeah, I just graduated this year in April.
Okay, yeah.
So I'm still getting used to the title even.
Right, I can imagine.
Yeah,
the title, but it's a weighty title.
It is.
It suggests a lot of things. I remember when I was in graduate school and, you know, would go to parties at that point in my life, and people would, you know, when they asked me what I was doing, you know, and I'd say, well, I'm a psychology graduate student, immediately they'd say, oh, you're probably analyzing me now.
Oh, yes.
You know, they were very, very defensive. And I wasn't. I wasn't thinking of that.
Exactly. You know, and I think our media and our culture has, well, a lot of people didn't really like Freud, so it created a stigma. And Freud didn't like America. He didn't want psychoanalysis here at all. He did not support it. People did it anyway. They went against some of his basic ideas. He didn't want it to be a medical treatment. He right. wanted it to be a study of the soul. And we, the medical field absorbed it into the licensure area. And it became that you had to be an MD to conduct a psychoanalytic session, which pulled it into there's, you need something to be wrong with you so that you can get the diagnosis. And that pulled people into fear about going for treatment. There's something wrong with me. They're going to tell me something. And that's exactly why Freud didn't want it here. So it's sort of gone on a journey of stigma with stigma attached to it that I think we're just now starting to work on, and the public is talking more and more about mental health today, like this year, than ever before. So I think it's great. And I personally, I'm very happy to be on this show because I think it's important to talk more about what psychoanalysis really is, because there's a lot of misconception about it.
Yes, yes.
People worry.
Yeah. You mentioned psychodynamic, and I think that term tends to be used a lot by people who have been strongly influenced by the Freudian and post-Freudian psychology, psychotherapy, if you will, mm-hmm. but are not graduates of an institute right. necessarily, so that they have training as a psychotherapist, but the coloration that they bring to that is they call psychodynamic.
Sure. So
they do their best to incorporate the things you've been talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. You might not have a psychoanalytic certification. You may not have done all of the requirements necessary to be called a psychoanalyst in like the grand scheme of how they, you know, certify people, but you might like have a liking towards psychodynamic treatment, and you might have some affinity for it. And so people will use that term who are not graduates of institutes.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are the challenges for you at this point in your career?
The challenges. Well, I don't take insurance. So that's a challenge.
Yeah. Well, that's a challenge for the people who are going to come. What frequency do you see people with? I mean, it's a big challenge in the classical model where often people were, and I'm not sure that Freud actually did this, but somehow it evolved to a place of people coming 3 days a week or five days a week, and that going on for years and years. That's very expensive.
Yes, yes. The classical model is 3 to 5 times a week. I don't know if Freud was so much about years and years, because he thought he would tell people, you know, maybe hold off on making major life choices before a year. So he kind of, he thought like at a year of 3 to 5 a week, okay, that's some good analyzing. But modern analysts, we, like I said before, we like for the patient to tell us where they're at. So we'll take the temperature of a client's psyche based on frequency. We don't like to overstimulate people. We have strong affinity for making sure the patient is at an insulated level that really works for them. So too much of a good thing could be a bad thing in a sense. And so it's really, it's something that I design with the client. Like, what are they interested in? Is once a week enough? Maybe I have some people who come every other week. I have one person who came once a month for like 4 years, and now he's coming twice a week or twice a month. But I have some people who just call me when they want it, and that's perfectly fine. It's still considered psychoanalysis in the modern sense, if as long as you're discussing, like I said earlier, the transference and resistance components.
The transference, of course, gets hyped up.
Yeah.
By if you see somebody every day, you know, five days, 3 days a week, That's sort of like is turning up the heat.
Particularly
if the person's on the couch, they're not reading your facial expressions.
Absolutely.
And they begin to project, which is a good thing. begin to see.
In the treatment room.
In the treatment room, it's a good thing. Yeah, outside the treatment room, not so much.
Yeah. So Freud worked primarily with people, and this is another psychoanalytic term, but he worked with people who had object transference abilities. So people who could see him as an other, basically, is what that means. And they had enough ego strength that they could see the world around them objectively. And the modern analyst, people who are at more pre-Oedipal levels of development usually start with a narcissistic transference or a self-object transference. So that's not what Freud was interested in. So that's a big reason why modern analysts don't push for 3 to 5 sessions a week, because the person's psyche might explode with that and crack all over the place. We want to keep them in a nice incubated environment, so to speak.
That sounds paradoxical, because you are, I assume that part of what you are doing is getting them to look at their pain and to explore that. Would that be right or not?
So we don't make prescriptions in that way. People will look at their pain and people will talk about their pain, but we don't bring them to do it. We just ask them to say what they want to say. And in doing that, even if they're going to talk about the weather, or like, let's say someone's really interested in, hockey. You're like, in talking about hockey, you're probably going to be talking at the same time symbolically about your pain, just in the way that you might talk about a particular subject. So we're not looking to bubble up the unconscious stuff to the surface until the patient wants it to. And even then, we might regulate how much they're going to do that. I've had people want to talk about their past traumas, and I get the sense that maybe it's going to split them, or maybe it's going to lead them to a psychosis if they're exposed to the material in such an intimate way. And so I'll slow them down and we will talk about it slowly over time without a rush.
I see. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. They talk about not attacking the defenses.
Yeah.
And so that's a delicate balance, because earlier you said that the approach is all about transference and resistance. And so
studying it over time.
Over time. Yeah. I was going to say, how do you titrate the dealing with the resistance? And so it's a matter of timing.
Yeah. Following the patient, two of the techniques that Spotnitz created, one was asking object-oriented questions.
Okay. I have to stop you there. That's one of those, psychoanalytic terms that it took me a long time to adjust to it all, because object means what?
Outside of you.
It refers to a person, right?
It refers to anything. Like, so an ego-oriented question would mean something about, like, if I'm the client, it would be someone asking me about me. But an object-oriented question would be asking about something around me that doesn't have to do with my identity or my personal self. So leading a client with object oriented questions would mean, like, instead of saying like, how do you feel, you might say like, oh, how did they feel? And you get them to explain their story, or tell you about their life in a way that's a little more safe, because you can still get to the root of everything without pulling someone into that feeling that you get when a teacher calls on you. Like, what's the answer?
Yeah.
You want to remove that from the therapy room. There's already enough frustration and fear and uncomfortable feelings that eliminating that with, gentle questioning and also at the same time following the patient's lead. So if they are talking about a topic, probably it's safe to talk about that. Yeah. But you don't necessarily want to go into uncharted territory too fast.
Have you had to deal with anybody who didn't talk?
Oh, yeah. Yes,
sometimes patients come and they're very silent.
They are. And you can, if you're attuned with the person, you can get a sense as to whether or not they're comfortable with that, if they like it. And you might check in with them, like, how's the silence? Should I be asking you questions? Should I let you talk when you're ready? I've had people fall asleep.
Oh boy.
I had one person though.
Were they on the couch?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah. Falling asleep.
Yeah. But sometimes they fall asleep just because they're lulled to sleep by the treatment, you know, being in the space where there's a sound machine and it's calm, it's peaceful. They get a chance to sleep finally, maybe for the first time in their life in a therapeutic situation, maybe.
Well, I get a sense that you're very kind and you make a lot of space for them and develop an atmosphere of safety.
Yeah, number one. I mean, if you go in with a jackhammer or if you try to hatch them before they are, I mean, people develop on their own, like naturally. Yeah. It's part of the process as an individual, but how they're doing that and how they've been helped along the way to do that, I think is a primary focus. That if you sit in the passenger seat and you are a guide for what's ahead, like if you hold the torch and let them proceed, they're going to build autonomy. They're going to feel like they're going to grow in their identity, their self-confidence. If you do it for them, there might be like more negative repercussions later down the road as far as human development is concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned when I said, what are the challenges that you see down the road? And you mentioned no insurance. It's not.
Oh yeah.
Oh, you don't take insurance.
That's a little more periphery. Were you meaning like psychologically? What are the challenges?
Yeah. Or, take it any way that you want.
Yeah, I mean, people getting set up, getting the person to call is a challenge. I think people are afraid. They are not sure what they're going to get if they work with an analyst or a therapist in general. They think they're going to be judged, like you said. Those are big challenges just in getting the treatment started. But then there's also challenges along the way where resistances crop up of people. That might be where a particular topic disorganizes them.
I guess I did mean more, what are the challenges for you as you look ahead in your career?
Oh, my career.
Yeah, the things that you want to learn more about, or places where you want to grow or see yourself develop.
I would love to. I'm working as a board member at the American Board for Psychoanalytic Accreditation, and so I haven't yet done any audits of the schools, but I'm planning to like move in that direction with the organization. Right now I'm working on building a task force for them on public relations and helping the organization and psychoanalytic studies in general to branch out to the public and show face a little more and help people feel more comfortable with what we're doing. And the, you know, it's not just Freud anymore. There's so many other people that have been developing the theories, and how we're working now is totally different. So just branching out into the public eye and helping to foster a better relationship. But that's a pretty big task.
Yeah, you're a fast mover. I mean, you're moving right away into the political arena of psychoanalysis and the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see how it goes. I mean, it's a lot of work to help a nation reorient themselves with something that historically has been a rough relationship.
Well, I wonder if there's anything more that we haven't touched on that you are hoping to get to today.
I don't know. I mean, it's been a great conversation.
Yeah.
Do you think it was like well-rounded enough? Should we talk it? Do you have an idea where it might go next?
I don't.
Well, then maybe we did what we needed to do.
Okay. I think we have. So it's at this point that I typically say, Amanda Lennox, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you. It was so nice to meet you.
It's interesting to me that today's guest, psychoanalyst Amanda Lennox, wandered into psychoanalysis more or less by accident. She decided to seek out some personal therapy after walking away from a promising career in dance. As she tells the story, she became disenchanted with dance because of its shaming and authoritarian traditions going all the way back to King Louis XIV, who created the Académie Royale de Danse in 1661, which in turn set the exacting tone and methods that have come down to us today. Lennox, who appears to be quite slim, was criticized for being fat and having carbs on her plate. Somewhere around that time, she realized that the joy of dance had gone out for her. She went to see a therapist on a friend's recommendation, and this therapist just happened to be a member of the Analytic Institute in the adjacent building, and suggested she might also like to study there. This story reminded me that I had also stumbled into psychoanalytic thought by getting into a doctoral clinical psychology program at the University of Michigan without knowing a thing about their orientation. In our conversation, it struck me that maybe Lennox had abandoned one authoritarian institution only to wind up in another. However, as luck would have it, the Philadelphia School of Psychoanalysis she attended was perhaps more liberal than the version I experienced at Michigan. The Philadelphia Institute evidently specializes in a variant of analytic thinking known as modern analysis. I certainly was aware that analysis has evolved in various directions since the time of Freud. So when I first heard Lennox refer to modern analysis, I took the term to be broadly descriptive of this evolution rather than a specific system. That was the first thing I learned in this interview. In addition, I learned that this specific system has a founder, someone I'd not heard of before. According to Wikipedia, Hyman Spotnitz was an American psychoanalyst and psychiatrist who pioneered an approach to working psychoanalytically with schizophrenics in the 1950s, and he called it modern psychoanalysis. He also was one of the pioneers of group therapy. And as we heard from my guest, Amanda Lennox, Spotnitz's ideas were heavily influenced not only by Freud, but also by Ferenczi, Winnicott, Guntrip, Ballant, Serlis, Kernberg, Glover, Kohut, Little, and Reich. Lennox also let us know that while modern analysis concerns itself with a focus on transference and resistance, the approach is surprisingly relaxed in the way it deals with these dynamics. In her own practice, Lennox invites the client to use the analytic couch or not, as they choose over the course of their sessions. She lets them choose the agenda and the speed at which they feel ready to move. The frequency of sessions varies from client to client and may vary for a given client according to their needs. She believes that any sort of pressure from the analyst may be damaging to the client. She believes the client needs to feel both comfortable and safe in order to unfold in their own unique way and pace. Her stance strikes me as very permissive in an almost Rogerian way. I'm struck also by her ambition as a rather newly minted analyst to move into positions of influence within her profession, to create public initiatives that will break down the negative stereotypes that prevent people from seeking analytic treatment.
Hi, Dave. My name is Dr. Michael O'Canna, and I am a medical director for an adolescent psychiatric unit up here in British Columbia. I've been listening to your podcast for about a week now, and in summary, I'm thrilled. You've collected interviews with some of the most exciting thinkers in neuroscience and mental health treatment today. I agree with the recent direction of your thinking. The age of Pax Medica is coming to a close, and a much more exciting era seems to be on the horizon. So, I have decided to show my support, and I encourage all of your listeners to do the same. Just hit that support button and show Dave that you care. It feels good. Thanks, Dave, and I look forward to keeping up with your podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Michael O'Connor. His message of support was recorded some time back, and he and his wife have been strong supporters over the years. If you haven't already done so, I do hope you'll join them. I'm still hoping to hear from a potential transcriber who's willing to use otter.ai, which will do all the heavy lifting of making a transcription. So if you're interested in trying that, willing to try that, you can help out here by dropping me a line at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Also, I'm looking for a volunteer with mad Instagram skills to help us get the word out about Shrink Wrap Radio there. I don't have mad Instagram skills myself, so I could use some help. Also, I've mentioned that another way you can contribute is by patronizing my favorite audiobook service, which is Libro.fm. If you're not already a member, you can get 3 audiobooks of your choice for the price of 1, which is just $14.95. So take advantage of this offer by going to libro.fm/redeem/shrink and click on the redeem button. And yet one more way that you can help out is by joining ExpressVPN. VPN, of course, stands for Virtual Private Network. ExpressVPN hides your IP address and encrypts your network data so no one can see what you're doing, whether it's your desktop computer at home or your mobile device out in the world. For about $100, you'll get 15 months of protection, plus there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. I'm doing it, so why not you? Just go to www.tryexpressvpn.com/shrink. I'm going to get this podcast out a day earlier than usual because of a tooth implant I'll be getting tomorrow morning. I know it's going to leave me a little out of it, and also I'm forbidden to speak for a period of time. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up once again. Thanks to psychoanalyst Amanda Lennox for educating us about a specific approach known as modern analysis. And next week, my guest will be Dr. Adam Asoyan, who will be speaking about his experiences working with adolescent and adult sexual offenders. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.